I don't think it's appropriate for attack ads to find their way into a state-funded voter guide.
A legislative effort to ban partisan ads from Alaska's official voter pamphlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 25th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Ketchikan wins a lawsuit against the state over an education funding mandate.
We gotta have some fist bumps going on here. You should stand up, take a bow, do a jig, do something other than just calmly report that, yeah, we won.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The State Division of Elections took some heat this year for publishing an attack ad against Senator Mark Begich within the pages of the official voter guide. Now Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, wants to ban partisan ads in the guide, a booklet that's mailed to every voting household.
People hear enough in the form of political attack ads during an election. I don't think it's appropriate for attack ads to find their way into a state-funded voter guide.
By statute, political parties are allowed to buy up to two full-page ads for $600 apiece, and the Division of Elections has no say over the content. Until this year, the parties mostly used the space to list their party platforms, but now that the Republican Party of Alaska has used the space for a more aggressive message, Guerra says other parties are likely to do the same. Republican Party Chairman Peter Goldberg says he got a few angry complaints about the anti-Begich ad, but he's not convinced it had much impact since a lot of voters don't read the guide. Goldberg says he just wanted to make sure the party used its ad space effectively.
When someone suggested a negative ad, why not? The objective of a political party is to win an election. And you take advantage of every opportunity you can to look for opportunities to sway voters.
Guerra says he plans to pre-file the bill and will be looking for co-sponsors from both parties. The city and borough of Juneau's lobbyist for state issues says Alaska's budget woes may lead to conversations during the upcoming legislative session about tapping the Alaska Permanent Fund. Kevin Jardell also says it's likely to mean fewer state-funded capital projects for communities, though he thinks Governor-elect Bill Walker will be favorable to local governments. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
About 90% of state revenue comes from oil taxes, and the price of Alaska's oil is trending down.
The reality of going into this next year and the new administration, if oil averages $85, the deficit for the state is about $3 billion.
Kevin Jardell told the Juneau Assembly on Monday that Alaska North Slope crude oil needs to be about $117 a barrel for the state to balance its budget. It was about $77 a barrel at the end of last week. During the campaign, outgoing Governor Sean Parnell and Governor-elect Bill Walker sparred over how much to cut spending to deal with the budget shortfall. In January, Jardell expects lawmakers and the Walker administration to shift the conversation to ways to increase revenue. He says that includes using the state's $51 billion permanent fund.
And I think communities are going to have to sit and think about where they stand on the issue and whether they're going to weigh in.
As for cuts, Jardell says the state capital budget will be hit the hardest, with most of the funding going to projects that require a match to secure federal dollars for infrastructure like roads.
I think the capital budget will be strictly a what they call a bare bones capital budget.
On the bright side, Jardell says the incoming Walker administration is talking a lot about meeting the needs of municipalities.
They're really focused on hearing from local governments and ensuring that the state is aligned with the priorities of local governments. And that's when one of Governor-elect Walker's priorities, it comes from his history and his being in local government.
Walker is a former mayor of Valdez. Incoming Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott is a former mayor of Yakutat and Juneau. Jardell's comments came at the Assembly's annual retreat. Assemblymember Kate Troll called his predictions a new reality check. City Manager Kim Kiefer said the Assembly's Finance Committee will revisit the city's state funding requests on December 17th. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
A Superior Court judge has ruled in favor of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough in its lawsuit against the state of Alaska over the state's education funding mandate. The Borough Assembly talked about Friday's ruling during this week's regular meeting, and Borough Manager Dan Bockhorst calls it a big win for Ketchikan. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Superior Court Judge William Carey says boroughs are not required to help pay for public education. In his ruling, he says that the contribution is essentially a tax, earmarked for a special purpose, which violates the state's constitution. This is a big deal for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, which filed the lawsuit in January after years of talking about whether to take that step. The borough argues that the mandatory local contribution is unfair to organized boroughs and first-class cities because it doesn't apply to smaller communities in unorganized boroughs. Ketchikan Borough Manager Dan Bockhorst has led the charge on this issue. Considering the efforts he's put into it, his announcement of the court ruling was calm. He simply noted that the judge ruled in the borough's favor but didn't grant the borough's request for a refund of this year's local contribution to schools. Despite that small loss,
The major principal involved in that case, the borough was successful on that issue.
Later, Assemblymember Glenn Thompson chided Bockhorst for his presentation.
Mr. Bockhorst has to be the most subdued person I've ever met when he announces that this landmark decision of the Superior Court in favor of the borough.
We got to have some fist bumps going on here.
You know, you should stand up, take a bow, you know, do a jig, do something other than just calmly report that, yeah, we won.
Thompson noted that the added cost to the state that could result from this ruling is nothing compared to the projected drop in oil tax revenue.
Putting it in perspective, though, with the 30% drop in revenue at the state level, which I think equates to around $3 billion, the $300,000 problem we've handed them with the unconstitutionality of the required local contribution is merely a drop in the bucket. So it'll just get lost in the trees. It shouldn't be that big of a problem for them.
The State Department of Education's budget for the 2013-2014 academic year was $1.4 billion, and $222 million of that came from the required local contributions provided by the boroughs and first-class cities. How the state will respond to Judge Carey's ruling is up in the air. Lawyers representing the state government are evaluating the decision and any options available. What newly elected Governor Bill Walker might do also is unknown. During an October campaign stop in Ketchikan, though, he told KRBD that he understands the borough's frustration.
And there's some technical issues in that litigation. I think that they've got some good points about as far as dedication of revenues and those kinds of things.
Walker said the problem stems from the state pushing obligations onto local governments, and he would open lines of communication in hopes of resolving those disagreements. In the meantime, Borough Manager Bockhorst says he will confer with the borough's attorneys regarding what's next and will place an executive session on the Assembly's next meeting agenda to talk about strategies. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, training dogs to locate missing people in and around Juneau.
We always want the problem to turn out right for them. It helps advance their training.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
The National Marine Fisheries Service will reopen fishing grounds in the Western Aleutian Islands that have been closed for years to protect a population of stellar sea lions. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
NIMFS issued the new regulations Tuesday. They say some fishing spread out over more space and time won't deplete the sea lion's food source too much. Stellar sea lions eat Atka mackerel, Pacific cod, and pollock, which were harvested commercially in the Western Aleutians in the past. The fisheries were shut down in 2011 when NIMS first ruled that fishing posed too much of a threat to the endangered mammals. Now they're relaxing those restrictions, upholding recommendations that have taken shape this year. NIMS will reopen 35% more pollock fishing grounds compared to what was closed in 2011. They'll also reopen 8% more for Atka mackerel and 23% more for Pacific cod in the trawl and non-trawl sectors. Closures around sea lion haulouts and rookeries will still apply. The regulations also extend the fishing seasons for those species, but they still limit harvesting during times of year when the sea lions appear to be eating more fish, like pollock in the winter. The new management plan takes effect in 30 days. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Sitka's commercial herring fleet should expect to catch significantly fewer fish this spring. That's the news from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, which released its preliminary harvest target for the 2015 Sitka Sound Sacro herring fishery last week. The preliminary quota is just over 8,700 tons. That would be the lowest harvest level since 2003. The 2014 harvest at almost 17,000 tons was one of the largest ever. Fish and Game biologist Dave Gordon says the lower forecast is driven by the number of three-year-old fish joining the mature spawning population in Sitka Sound.
And very few, I mean almost none, I guess, showed up in the fishery last year. So it's really the lack of recruitment that is causing the population to contract at this time.
Gordon says that contraction could be caused by a wide range of environmental factors that likely include food availability and water temperatures. Critics of the sacro herring fishery, including the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, worry that the commercial harvest is depleting the herring population. The department will take samples again in late January or early February and announce the final harvest level in late February or early March. The sacro herring fishery usually opens in March. Representatives from Calista Corporation met at the Cultural Center in Bethel earlier this month with shareholders and descendants to discuss the details of an upcoming vote on whether to issue shares to afterborns or those born after December 1971, when newly formed Alaska Native corporations enrolled their shareholders. KYUK's Charles Enoch reports.
Calista President and CEO Andrew Guy and Chairman Willie Casaioli shared information about what shareholders can expect if Calista shareholders triple in number. One of the shareholders' main concerns focused on how much the annual dividend would decrease. Bethel resident and shareholder Stanley Hoffman says he would rather not have his annual dividend diluted further, giving a comparison between Calista and other regional corporations who issue shares that are in the tens of thousands.
I can see them doing that and get a healthy dividend. If this passes, we'll never see another dividend. The way I look at it, my kids will benefit more, too, because they'll get my shares after I die. The way it is right now, they're not benefiting at all.
For example, if Calista gave out dividends to its 12,900 shareholders at $3.50 per share like it did earlier this year, a shareholder with 100 shares would receive $350. But if the number of shareholders triples to as much as over 40,000, Calista would have to reduce the dividends to as much as a third of the original worth. In the example, that would bring the dividend down to $1.08 per share, and the average shareholder would receive around $108. Other issues that were mentioned at the Bethel meeting were possible increases in administrative costs and the difficulty of reaching a quorum during future shareholder meetings, among other things. Also, shareholders will not be able to gift or transfer these new shares, and these shares die with the shareholders, so to speak. Bethel resident Connie Sankwitz is a Calista shareholder. She says the meeting included information she believes many have not considered.
This presentation was really good. It was very well outlined. I think that when the vote was initially passed in 2011, where shareholders, the majority of the shareholders wanted to see a vote to enroll descendants, that the majority of the shareholders were not well informed on what would happen.
Jalista shareholders voted on a proposal in 2011 to look at the possibility of issuing shares to descendants. Representatives from Jalista will meet with shareholders from different communities in the near future to answer questions. Sometime next year, possibly during the summer months at the annual meeting, shareholders will vote on whether descendants will be issued shares. The date and location of the meeting will be decided during the next Jalista quarterly meeting in the first week of December. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is tripling enrollment in its middle school academies after receiving a $6 million state grant. The program hopes to get middle school students, especially Alaska Natives, interested in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. KTOO's Sarah Yu has more.
Last year, there were four middle school academies in the spring and summer, each with 54 students between grades 6 and 8. Next year, they will have 12 sessions held all year round. The grant money will be split over 3 years. Michael Bordakovsky is ANSEP's chief operations officer. He says the grant will go toward housing for students at UAA, travel, academic materials, and staff support, among other things. Bordakovsky was a participant in ANSEP's university program, but feels that students coming out of the middle school academies have an early advantage.
With the exposure that we're providing students now to college life, to campus life, to the expectations of students once they get to college, you know, I didn't have any of that, and I kind of went in blind.
He graduated with an engineering degree from UAA and says ANSEP was critical in keeping him on track. Bordakovsky says ANSEP accepts about half of academy applicants, and there are never enough slots for interested students. Students can only go to the program once, but are encouraged to participate in other ANSEP initiatives afterward. Jules Mermelstein is only 15, but is set to graduate next year from West Valley High School in Fairbanks. He says that ANSEP encouraged him to set his goals higher and graduate early.
Like, I definitely wouldn't have been doing a three-year track had it not been for, like, ANSEP's initial, like, push to get me interested.
Mermelstein originally wanted to be an archaeologist, but became fascinated with mechanical engineering when he attended an academy in sixth grade.
We built like a balsa wood bridge, and while my group may have not done the best, because it's like many, many different groups competing, and it was still like really interesting and fun to like learn how to like build stuff, because that's nothing that's like really introduced in school other than like a candy cane house or something.
He hopes to continue along the ANSEP track in college, going either to UAA or University of Alaska Fairbanks. When he graduates, he says he would like to work on in-state renewable energy projects. The grant to expand the middle school academies came through House Bill 278, championed by Governor Sean Parnell. In Juneau, I'm Sarah Yu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Gnomes, nonprofits, and churches will continue to be spared from paying local sales tax after last night's city council meeting saw proposals to strip the exemptions die without a vote. The city is trying to find more revenue after disappearing state and federal funding left a roughly $800,000 hole in the budget. More than two dozen people packed city council chambers to hear nonprofit directors speak out against the tax ordinance. Fresh from attending last week's Alaska Municipal League, that's a gathering of city administrators from around the state, Nome City Manager Josie Banky says other Alaska cities, large and small, are facing similar budget shortfalls and scrambling for revenue.
Some of the other challenges, I think, is, you know, really the disconnect between what residents see and what they want and what they're willing to pay for. I think this is going to continue on here through the next several months, of course. Sometimes there's disagreement on what the core functions of the city are, what they should be.
One new tax ordinance did move forward, a proposal to assess property tax on aircraft. City attorneys have suggested such a tax as a way to bring in significant revenue, but Paul Kostko, the Nome station manager for Alaska Airlines, tells the council taxing aircraft could send businesses to other rural hubs like Bethel, Kotzebue, or Unalakleet.
There's some real-life ramifications for the airline industry if you were to start taxing aircraft. Nome would lose not only aircraft, they would lose services, and they would lose jobs.
City Council members countered that enough city services like police, fire, EMS, as well as city sewer and water are working at the airport to warrant the tax. An orphaned bear cub from the Eagle area is at the Alaska Zoo. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the young black bear will be kept at the facility in Anchorage while a search is conducted for a permanent home.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says the state moved the bear to the Alaska Zoo over the weekend, a long trip that started with a small plane ride.
Got it back to the ground in Tok, drove it to Fairbanks, and it drove in another truck down to Anchorage, and it was perfectly docile and healthy and calm, and everything went well.
Eagle residents Kate Rorick and Andy Basich cared for the small black bear cub since it showed up at their remote homestead alone a week ago. The couple fought an initial state plan to euthanize the bear, which is too young to survive in the wild. Seven Alaska bear cubs, all but one black, have been placed outside already this year, and it's expected to be tough to find an approved wildlife care facility to take the new cub. Harm says the Alaska Zoo will serve as a temporary home for the animal.
It is being housed there while we await applications that come in and check with previous permit holders to find out if we can find a permanent residence for this cub.
Harm says the Alaska Zoo transferred three bear cubs from Galena to a facility in Colorado last Thursday, opening up room for the eagle cub. Rourke, Basich, and friends are trying to find the bear a similar outside arrangement. Basich says there's interest, but he expects nothing to happen fast.
In a perfect world, we'd love to be able to ship them out and ship them right down to a new home. But as we all know, government agencies have a lot of bureaucracy involved, and that seems to slow the process down dramatically.
The state's Harms credits the public for helping find a home for the Galena bears and welcomes similar assistance with the eagle cub, but she defends the state's methodical approach.
Lots of facilities can say step forward, but unless they have a permit from the Department of Fish and Game, it is not legal to transfer that animal to them.
Harms says there's no deadline for finding a new home for the cub. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
At least once a week, 10 handlers and their dogs muck through the mountains, muskegs, and forests on and off the beaten paths of Juneau in search of volunteer hiders. It's practice for the Sea Dogs, or Southeast Alaska Dogs Organized for Ground Search. Local authorities call on the volunteer group several times a year to help out when people go missing. KTOO's Lisa Fu attended a fall practice and has this story.
Mark Sanders and his dog, Brew, are searching the Muskeg Meadow off Fish Creek Road leading to Eagle Crest Ski Area. They're looking for a mother, father, and two daughters who volunteer to hide.
Sometimes it's like, you get a little creative. I've got a family of four. They're out berry picking, and this is where they were last seen. And, you know, there you go. Here's your search area, looking for four people.
Brew's search command is find him.
Brew.
And Sanders says the dog knows when they're on a mission.
Find him.
Brew runs ahead of Sanders, intent on a search.
He's ranging pretty good. You know, the ranging is like, you know, when the dog is working far away from you, you know, and they're not right next to you, kind of looking for direction. Where he's kind of like independently out there searching around. And so then when he runs into a hot scent, and he's going to follow that into the source.
The four-year-old golden retriever was two when Sanders decided to train him for search and rescue. Most of the other sea dogs were puppies when they started getting trained.
When he finds the origin of the scent, then he'll come back and give a barking alert. Brew.
Sanders and Brew are the newest team to join Sea Dogs, but they've already had a real-life find. In September, Brew located Kevin Mashad, a ptarmigan hunter who'd been missing overnight on Mount Roberts. Sea Dogs and their handlers get called on searches multiple times a year. Stacy Polson and her golden retriever Sage have found four people and been involved in numerous other searches where there have been finds.
Except for Sharon on Mount Roberts, who never found her. So,
Juneau resident Sharon Bice went missing in May. Her car was found parked at the Mount Roberts trailhead. Local search groups, Alaska State Troopers, and the U.S. Coast Guard scoured the area for days. Friends and volunteers continued looking for weeks after the official effort was called off. Polson and Sage were part of several searches. Polson says the dogs did show interest based on the scent of a glove from Bice's car.
They indicated areas that Sharon had clearly gone by and could have stopped and had lunch or changed her shirt or, you know, something, tighter shoe. So a strong pull of scent the dogs will indicate on.
But that's not enough, says Polson.
She walked that trail, and we all know that. Where she went from that trail, we don't know.
In those situations, the dogs can get discouraged. So the handlers will hide someone in the woods the dogs can find.
We always want the problem to turn out right for them. It helps advance their training. If they keep going on a search and nothing happens, then they never get rewarded, and so they have no reason to want to continue to search.
Even when it's a suicide, the dog needs a happy ending. That's the kind of find Sage had last spring in Haines. Polson says the dogs feel tragedy as much as humans do.
When she found her suicide victim, her tail was tucked in. She didn't do the bark alert that she's trained to do, but she let me know that he was there very quietly. And so a reward in that instance is very important because she's sad and she's confused and she doesn't like the smell, but she's still working and she did the job, and so she deserved the reward.
Sage got a rope pull toy. Polson says that type of situation can be difficult emotionally, but she focuses on the fact that it was a find.
It was successful, and you know that it provided closure for the family, and that's the important thing.
Back in the muskeg,
show me.
Brew leads Sanders to the missing family.
Come here, Ruth.
And gets a ball for his efforts. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And you got a ball. And you got a ball.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had help tonight from Lisa Fu, Casey Kelly, and Sarah Yu in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Rachel Walhals in Sitka, Charles Enoch in Bethel, Matthew Smith in Nome, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Liz Ruskin in Washington. Our producer's Annie Feit, our audio engineer, Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
You've heard of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Well, now you're hearing about Giving Tuesday, a day to kick off the season of giving back on Tuesday, December the 2nd. Celebrate the season of giving with Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Community Foundation on Tuesday, December the 2nd by giving a gift to the cause you care about most. When you live and give in Alaska, you make a real difference in your home community.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.